Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Depression often sets off different behaviors, sometimes recognized by others and not by the depressed person. Depression in men is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious, as we talk with David B. Wexler, Ph.D., the author of Is He Depressed or What? What to Do When the Man You Love is Irritable, Moody, and Withdrawn. Dr. Wexler, a clinical psychologist, discusses how to recognize when you or someone you love is depressed, how to talk about it in respectful and successful ways while taking care of yourself. When I spoke with Dr. Wexler from his home in San Diego, California, we began by discussing different categories of depression and how the symptoms of depression in men are different from the symptoms of depression in women. Dr. David Wexler, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
In your book about depression in men, how do you define depression? What is depression?
There are a couple of different main categories that we're now discovering as part of depression. I think that most people, even people who are not professionals or in the helping professions, most people know when somebody who they care about is starting to look depressed. And some of the signs would be that they are withdrawing from activities that they used to enjoy. They seem to be saying things that sound like they're feeling the world looks very negative. There's what's called the negative triad, which is a negative view of oneself, a negative view of others, and a negative view of the future. You hear that sounding in their language. Often you'll see them lose or gain appetite in a significant way, and likewise either be unable to sleep or have excessive sleeping. All of those are some of the typical signs that I think most people can recognize.
Your book focuses on depression in men. Are those symptoms for both genders?
Well, what we find is that approximately half of the cases of depression in men pretty much meet the standard profile for depression, much like what I was just describing before, what I think most people would recognize. However, there is another approximately 50% of true depression in men that shows up very differently, and that's what's now being known as male-type depression.
And what is that?
That is a depression in which the man experiences a lot of the same internal states that we associate with depression, but he identifies it differently in his own mind. He isn't able to call it the same things, and it gets expressed in some typically male ways. And some of those patterns that we're seeing are what we call exaggerated behavior. Exaggerated behavior means doing more, working harder, drinking more, engaging in more high stimulation or sometimes rather reckless behavior like gambling or physical risk-taking or flirting with somebody at the office party in a way that's kind of reckless. Sometimes it can be wanting more sexual experiences, either with one's partner or outside of the relationship. What you see at the exaggerated behavior is a guy who's desperately trying to get away from the feelings of depression by somehow recharging his system or showing that he is a more successful or non-depressed guy.
Are these feelings of depression predictable, or are there certain kinds of circumstances where they are more likely to be manifested?
Well, they're predictable somewhat. It's obvious to anybody that certain kinds of life losses or life problems set the stage for depression. You know, if you lose a job or your relationship breaks up or a loved one dies or if something happens to you physically and you're an athlete and you're not able to do what you normally could do, those are things that can trigger depression. And there's certainly different phases of life that seem to be higher risk for depression. When a high school kid goes off to college, a lot of kids become very depressed. When during midlife, we know there's a time when people are more vulnerable to depression. So some of that, I think, is predictable, but frankly, a lot of the depression in men or women that I see, I would not have been able to predict, but it happens because of some combination of life circumstances and that person's particular wiring.
By wiring, you mean genetic makeup?
genetic makeup, and also I mean a personality structure, the way that they that person views the world. A lot of times, I guess this would be another semi-predictable event. A lot of times, after a couple has a child, that's a time when a lot of men often feel depressed. Now, they may not call it depression, but they experience a sense of feeling cut off from the attention that they used to get more exclusively from their wife. They feel burdened by the responsibility of family. They feel stressed out, of course, by all the demands of having a young child in your home. And a lot of men will go through that and feel like, God, I don't. My life is not the way it used to be. I can't. I don't feel as free to do the things I want. I'm feeling unsuccessful at a lot of things I'm trying. That's something that can lead to some of the kinds of behaviors that we're talking about. I guess I'd also like to just explain a little bit more about some of the classic patterns you see with this. One category I said was the exaggerated behavior. Another one is what's called avoidance and escape, and basically that means that the guy is trying to withdraw from any situations that might lead to depression. He might withdraw socially. He might withdraw in his work situation. He might not want to engage in any kinds of conversations with his wife or partner or anybody else that could lead him to feel bad about himself. It's like sort of the I don't want to talk about it syndrome, because if I talk about it, maybe you will point out something to me that will make me feel bad about myself, and I would just rather stay away from that entire subject. That whole cluster is another pattern that you see a lot with men. And one other key area that's one of the hallmark of the ways in which this male-type depression affects relationships is what I call projection of blame. And, you know, that's a classic psychology term in which, in this situation, a man is feeling bad about himself in some way. He's feeling this thing we're calling depression. He doesn't have a language for it. He doesn't know what to even call it for himself. He doesn't really know how to talk about it very well. What he does instead is find someone whose fault it must be. It's your fault that I'm feeling this way. It's because you don't give me enough attention. It's because the kids are so difficult. It's because my boss isn't treating me well. There's always somebody else who must be responsible for these bad feelings. And when that gets lodged into a man's brain or his story about his marriage, he then feels quite justified in treating her rather poorly, because she's the one who's making him feel bad, and what comes out is this irritable and moody and blaming pattern, sometimes to the point of more serious levels of abuse and aggression, other times at a more mild level, but either way, it's a problem.
But you're not limiting this just to men.
No.
This characterization of projection of blame.
No. I guess none of the things we're talking about we could say is black and white, like only men or only women, and even these different types of depression we're talking about, there's very rarely anything resembling a pure type. But we are talking about trends and clusters. In general, women are more likely to talk about their feelings and what they're going through when they're feeling depressed. They'll say things like, I'm feeling bad, or I feel like my life is going nowhere, or I don't like who I am, or various things that are clear statements about depression. Men in general, although there's a million exceptions both ways, men in general are less likely to put that into language, and it's more likely to come out in some of the behavioral patterns that we're talking about.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Dr. David B. Wexler from his home in San Diego, California. He's the author of Is He Depressed or What? What to Do When the Man You Love is Irritable, Moody, and Withdrawn. Dr. Wexler, let's talk about labeling depression. Is that the right way to approach the issue with the D word?
Sometimes, with the kind of men we're talking about, you can have what I would call a perfectly normal, straightforward discussion. You sit down with them. I mean, when I say you, I mean somebody, his wife or partner or somebody who cares about him or loves him, could sit down with him and say, you know what, honey, I really feel like you've been withdrawing a lot lately, and it's been difficult for you to get up in the morning and feel like you're starting to drink more than you used to do. I'm really concerned about you. It really seems like you're feeling depressed. And once in a while, the guy will say, God, you know what, I think you're right. I've been feeling that same way, I just haven't known how to talk about it. I think I need to get some help with this. That's like the dream conversation that's supposed to happen. However, that is much more the exception than the norm. And what's more typical is if a woman tries to approach a man that way, he'll say, what are you talking about? I'm not depressed. If anybody's depressed around here, it's you. Look at me. I'm working fine. I'm doing my thing. I'm sorry if I'm not available all the time, but somebody around here has got to make a living. And he'll launch into a very defensive response about being labeled this way.
Projection of blame.
It's a projection of blame, correct. And part of what gets in the way there is a certain attachment to masculine identity. Because for most men, a word like depression is associated with very non-masculine characteristics, such as feeling weak, vulnerable, indecisive, ineffective, unsuccessful, etc. And those things, I mean, women don't feel like feeling that way either, but those things are an exact 180-degree turn away from what most men are attached to as part of a masculine identity. So even if they are feeling those things, they will steadfastly refuse to acknowledge them because it feels so unmasculine. So if you toss out a word like depressed and he balks at it in the way that I was just suggesting or any of another thousand other ways, that's okay. That does not necessarily doom the conversation. You can call it something else. You can call it stress. You can call it burnout. You can call it feeling kind of wiped out or tired. The label does not matter. What does matter is that at some point he recognizes that certain characteristics, certain thoughts he's expressing, certain behaviors he's engaging in, certain things he's not doing that he used to do, are getting in the way and that they need some attention. Whether we call it depression or not, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter. I want to have a face-saving way for this guy to recognize some problems and do something about it.
What are those face-saving ways?
Well, in addition to this way we were just talking about, it's important that the message, whatever negative feedback or criticism is coming from someone else, and frankly we're talking about conversations in which, let's say, a wife is saying to the guy, it's bothering me that that every night when you come home you just withdraw from the rest of the family. That would be a criticism, even if it's stated nicely. It needs to be presented in a way that is least shaming as possible. In other words, if what comes from her is, you know, you never are doing anything. What's wrong with you? You've totally changed. I don't know what kind of man I married. That is not, even though it might be very justified from her point of view, that is not likely to get the job done because all the guy hears is threat. He hears, I am being told that I am a loser, I'm unsuccessful, I'm inadequate, etc., and all the defenses go up. Instead, she needs to use some more tried and true methods of getting through. For instance, reminding him of the things that you really appreciate and value about him, and also saying, but here's something I'm concerned about. And to make those concerns as specific as possible. A lot of guys, if they hear something like, you seem to be not yourself lately, or you seem to be, I feel like you're going through something, they'll say, well, what are you talking about? And it's helpful to have specific things, specific observable behavioral examples that he can sink his teeth into and hopefully say, maybe you're right about this. Another suggestion that I think helps grease the wheels of that conversation is women approaching men in this way, not give up just because the initial response is that wave of defensiveness. A lot of guys need some time to get used to this idea. And if she brings it up in the first week of February and he acts defensive, and then maybe a couple weeks later she mentions something again about what she's noticing and concerned about, and then maybe a few weeks later somebody else says something to him, or maybe she's suggested to somebody else that they say something to him, maybe by the third or fourth time, he might begin to say, okay, maybe I see what you're talking about. I guess I maybe need to get a little help with this. But to give up after the first time does not really respect how complicated it is for a man to accept that kind of label.
Well, again, is that gender specific?
That is pretty gender specific.
Why? And where's that come from in us?
that comes from the same place that men don't like asking for directions, or that men don't like to acknowledge that they're feeling inadequate.
Where is that place? Is that something in 21st century culture?
Well, it's probably less in 21st century culture than it was in 20th, 19th, 18th, and 17th, but it's still there. Somebody could probably identify some slightly genetic component to this, but it's primarily a learned set of behaviors and a learned set of expectations. There's an author, William Pollack, who wrote the book Real Boys that came out in the late 90s, and he's written several follow-ups to that book. He describes what's called the boy code, and the boy code is the set of rules and instructions about the way boys are supposed to act that every boy knows about, even though it's not written down anywhere and it's not explained anywhere. They all get it. It has to do with making sure that you don't appear weak, that you don't do anything that would let other people know that they have really affected you or that you care very much. And most importantly, you can't do anything that would make you appear like a girl. Boys learn those lessons on every playground, in every classroom, in every sports team, and through a lot of the media from very early on. I talk to pediatricians who say that they see parents coming in with their kids, and you get a five-year-old girl who's about to get a shot, and she starts crying, and the daddy holds her and says, "It's okay, honey, it's going to be all right, I'll be right here with you." Then the five-year-old boy comes in, and he's crying the same way, and the father says, "Now you tough it out, son, you be a man and you take it." Those messages are coming to kids from very early on, and boys incorporate that early. They learn how dangerous it is to vary from the boy code, to step outside of the box, and that carries into their adult life.
Are you recommending different messages to somewhat alleviate the problems when the boy is an adult?
Absolutely.
And those messages, what are they?
Well, the messages are in some ways very, very simple and straightforward. If a boy is obviously upset or troubled by something, the adults in his life need to approach him to talk about the feelings the same way that they would with a girl. There are study after study that show that parents talk to girls in feeling language and they talk to boys in action language. Even the mothers are likely to say, "Well, let's talk about what you can do about it." With girls, they're much more likely to talk about, "Well, tell me about how you feel about it." We can offer boys that same language or the same help them develop the same language about feelings as girls have typically been offered. It's also, I think, important that the role models in boys' lives, who are most typically their father, model behavior that shows that being masculine represents a wide range of behaviors. It's not just this narrow range of sort of a caricature of masculinity in which you keep a stiff upper lip and you stay in control of things and make sure that you never feel controlled by anybody else and you don't take guff from anybody else. What you want to see is that men are more flexible, that they can express feelings, that they can have a relationship of reasonable equality with the key women in their lives, and that modeling process goes a long way towards what happens in the next generation.
Dr. David Wexler, you mention the concepts of rumination and repetition of negative thoughts. You don't recommend that.
No. I see worrying and guilt and being in pain and anxiety and a lot of different rather negative experiences as being fundamental and reasonably healthy, or at least normal, aspects of being human up to a point. I think it helps to worry about things as long as the worrying leads to some sort of resolution or some sort of action. There comes a point, though, when worrying about something, either worrying about something you have done in the past or worrying about something you're anticipating in the future, when the worrying becomes paralyzing. And that's when we get into this category called rumination or obsessing. It means that a negative thought, either about past or future, is grinding away in a person's brain in a way that tears down some of their feeling of well-being and also does not really predispose them to handling the situation better in the future. It does not lead to any kind of productive action or resolution. If we were computers and we could just program ourselves, we would just say, "This is a dysfunctional activity, knock it off." You know, we're not quite that easily programmable.
So what are some examples and the negative programming that you speak of?
Well, plenty of the the people that I work with, male or female, spend a lot of time reviewing things that they have done wrong in the past, the way they have let somebody down, the way they have failed at something, and they go over it and over it and over it. And many situations in their life seem to trigger a wave of this obsessive, ruminative review of the negative thoughts. They blame themselves. They tell themselves things like, because I failed in this relationship, or because I never really made it into that career that I wanted to make it in, therefore I am permanently doomed in some way. Those thoughts, while I can be very empathic with what it's like to be inside of that, it is very non-constructive to become consumed by that.
How does a person keep that from consuming them? Without going to visit a person like yourself, a psychologist who's familiar with these issues.
Right. Well, some of the things that even a psychologist would tell you eventually become self-help techniques, in the sense that if you catch yourself ruminating in the way we're talking about, one very valuable strategy is what's called compartmentalization. What that means is that if you know that you are worrying every day about things you've done wrong in the past, or worrying every day about what's happening in your relationship, and you can't let go of it, instead, you set aside a certain block of time, like a 15-minute block, every evening from 6:30 to 6:45, you are going to become totally devoted and consumed to the with these kinds of negative thoughts. You're going to indulge them, allow them, turn the phone off, complete involvement in them. And at 6:45, when it's over, it's over, and you move on to other things. And the little part in your brain that's saying, wait a minute, we have to worry about this, you can reassure that little part of your brain, because you say, we have an appointment tomorrow evening at 6:30, you're going to be heard from. And I guarantee you, I'm going to be paying attention to what you're trying to tell me, but we're going to keep it into this particular 15-minute block. That is a very effective technique for some people, because it's not, you're not telling them, don't worry about it. You're just saying, put it in a controlled box so that it doesn't consume the rest of your life. Other typical strategies for dealing with this is what's called disputation, which basically means it's a fancy word or fancy version of rationally challenging some of the negative thoughts and beliefs. If you're telling yourself that you have failed at some important area of your life and you will never recover from that, or you will never get better, you want to talk to yourself in the way that you might talk to a friend who is saying the same things. You'd probably have a lot of very good input to help point out to this other person how irrational or how excessively global these thoughts are. And the disputation process is to really try to use that same kind of rational analysis with yourself. There's one other one, which is simply distraction. And I used to be very sort of cynical about people who employed distraction in dealing with difficult emotional states. I thought that was kind of like sweeping under the rug and just avoiding. But it seems to me that if the alternative is obsessing and ruminating, or getting yourself worked up into a state where you might act destructively or self-destructively in some way, distraction is a much better alternative.
Sounds like a step towards compartmentalization.
Yeah, compartmentalization would be one version of that. But classic distractions are the simplest things in the world. You're starting to feel really worried or depressed, so you go and listen to some music, or you go watch a movie, or you go work out, or you do some other activity that involves what they call absorption, where your mind and oftentimes your body is very absorbed in another activity. Obviously, the problems you're worried about don't go away because of that, but you are very likely to be able to come back with a fresher perspective, because you've gotten some distance. You've broken that powerful chain of thought patterns, and that interruption is a very effective technique for getting free of it.
Dr. David Wexler, author of Is He Depressed or What? What to Do When the Man You Love is Irritable, Moody, and Withdrawn. Thanks for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes. Several months ago, I came across a book called Dharma Punks, and Punks is spelled P-U-N-X. And for those of you familiar with any kind of Buddhist teachings, the word Dharma means the truth, or a path of truth. And it's written by a man named Noah Levine. His father, Stephen Levine, has written a number of books about Buddhist teachings and meditation. He wrote a very popular book called One Year to Live. And the story of Noah Levine, his son, is Noah Levine grew up in the 80s as a punker, and with every nihilistic, aggressive, self-destructive activity you can imagine, with drugs, alcohol, aggression. He was in and out of different kinds of juvenile facilities, police detentions, etc. And he had an absence of any kind of morals or values, and eventually hit rock bottom and found that some of the teachings that his father had always preached about Eastern approaches and meditation became a savior for him, a survival mechanism for him. And he channeled a lot of the intense energy he had, the rebellious energy of being a punker, into the pursuit of meditation and religious practice. It's a very, very inspiring story. It's the first half of the book, you hate this guy because of the kind of punk lifestyle he had. But what touched me the most is seeing somebody who was a man who felt so lost, life was so, felt so impossible, finding a way to turn it around, finding a different kind of center for himself, and in his own particular way, really becoming a person who loved himself and was capable of loving others. In my work with men, I find that kind of transformation process exhilarating, and it inspires me to do a lot of the work that I do.
Dr. David Wexler, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
David B. Wexler, Ph.D., is the author of Is He Depressed or What? What to Do When the Man You Love is Irritable, Moody, and Withdrawn. The book he recommends is Dharma Punks, P-U-N-X, by Noah Levine. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.